This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm pleased to have Joe with me today, and I would ask him to introduce himself a little bit, and then we'll start discussing about a very interesting topic that I have not discussed it with anybody else at SaaS Scaled yet. So, fresh topic, looking forward to it. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Armon. I'm super excited to be here. Just as a brief introduction for me, I'm currently a general partner at an early stage venture firm called HeavyBit. We focus on investing in pre-seed and seed companies doing enterprise infrastructure software. So that's everything from developer tools to DevSecOps, DevOps, even design analytics. Basically anything to do with building, operating, maintaining, securing software. Many of those companies, as you might imagine, are SaaS platforms used by their customers.
And I know that you have a technical background. You have been in the past even starting a company. If I'm correct, you exited yourself. You sold that company. Can you tell us a little bit about before you started this venture and
yourself? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been investing. I shouldn't have said I've been investing for like 6 years now. But prior to that, yeah, I spent the better part of almost 20 years. I dropped out of a computer science in PhD, as one does, to start working on startups. And I worked on a series of those, all in some kind of distributed systems infrastructure, everything from high performance computing to data center orchestration, automation. And then my last startup, I got really excited about cloud computing. In the late aughts and founded one of the very first cloud-native monitoring and observability platforms. It was a company called Librato. We were the first like hosted telemetry platform, SaaS platform for hosted telemetry. It was a great run. Sold that to SolarWinds in 2015 and got to spend a couple years there. They acquired us to kickstart their cloud-native business unit and got to spend a few years there helping to drive product strategy and four or five other acquisitions and a roll-up and learned a lot.
Fantastic. I'm going to, normally I don't do it, this is the first time I'm doing this, but I'm going to read exactly something LinkedIn that you guys have, because that was just nicely put. When I read it, it was just, to me, was so well written. I cannot, with my bad memory, there is no way I can even do the justice and right. 20% of that right. So I'm going to just read it for everyone, but encourage everyone to go also to the LinkedIn and look at your website and everything. But the very well explanation that you have put there, let me go there and just see. It should be somewhere here. If I go to the About tab, I think I read it there. And it says, HeavyBit is the leading investor in developer-first startups that turn visions into movements, products into platforms, and contributors into communities. And that's, I thought that it's very well written, very nicely done, very concise, actually. And can you tell us a little bit about your definition of, for example, when you say product to platforms? People might have different understanding of that. I wanted to hear from you as kind of how do you really define those terms?
Yeah, Yeah, no, happy. And I think it's important, you know, because I spend a lot of time with, you know, particularly new entrepreneurs. And so I think one of the first things you have to understand, you know, as a venture firm, early stage venture firm, like we're trying to invest, you know, not just in good businesses or even great businesses, but we're trying to invest in businesses that are going to be really generational, right? And I think particularly in infrastructure, there are loads and lots of good and great businesses. You know, I'm a big fan of like saying that, like, as long as you're ethical, there's really no wrong way to build a business, but there are like wrong ways to capitalize a business, right? And so for us, you know, the businesses we're looking to back in infrastructure really have to be either creating whole new categories, like, or at the very least redefining an existing category in a evolutionary way. And so if you are an entrepreneur doing that, one of the hardest things, which I imagine many of your audience are familiar with, you can find you have to find problem market fit, then product market fit. But then serial entrepreneurs will also know you have to find go-to-market fit finally, right? And particularly for enterprise tools, we believe the most powerful way to do that is what we always have referred to as a bottom-up go-to-market, where your end goal, like any enterprise go-to-market, is to have 80-90% of your revenue come from the top 10-20% of your customers. But having this long tail, a community movement platform of users, is a different way to create a lead gen flywheel. And if you're successful at it, it is the most defensible go-to-market. It is the most efficient go-to-market. And so with all of our companies at the early stage, we look to assess, and importantly, it's not possible for all products and categories, right? But for infrastructure with technical end users, it is often possible. And so with that in mind, a lot of what we tell our entrepreneurs, if they're going down that path, and this is the movement, so to speak, it is far better to create a notion of a future where your prospective customers buy into, hey, this is how the future is going to be built. And then following that, associate, and oh, by the way, the company that builds that future is this. And if you look at, there's companies like Sneak, who are instrumental from our portfolio in creating the DevSecOps movement. There's companies like Replicated with the Enterprise Ready movement, Netlify with the Jamstack movement. Another way to put it, I often say, is like market your manifesto, which is go out there and convince the world that your way is the right way. And then you follow that up with, and you're the correct company to do that. But yeah, we believe it takes a lot of upfront investment, and it's the hardest go to market to get right. But the end result is we think well worth the effort.
No, absolutely. And we have, definitely we have good success stories on what you just said. I think Databricks is a good example of that.
Sure.
So a good sized company, successful. Now, is it easy to do? No, but as you said, you know, it's definitely, you know, has proven to be a valid model. And, in old days, if you go back to some decades ago, maybe number of developers were not enough to really allow us to do such a thing. But nowadays, since the software economy, the software community has grown, we have a lot of developers. Now it's by itself is a market. Right. So it has become a kind of developer to developer for itself is a good size market.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting, I think there's two aspects. One is that, the number of developers. I mean, I have fond memories. I used to live in San Francisco, and I was able to attend GitHub's party. They threw a party when they had 1 million users, which sounded like, an obscenely high number. And I haven't seen the latest. But it's in the hundreds of millions now, right, on GitHub. And that's just in the last, 10 plus years. The other thing that I think is really interesting in this is if you go back to, I mean, I mentioned cloud computing before, but there was really, I think, two kind of movements that happened in the aughts, so pushing 15 years ago, that really unlocked this. So one is the movement to continuous delivery practices, right? So moving from traditional waterfall, pre-planned, centrally planned, annual release software cycles to SaaS, and not just SaaS, but then the ability to continuously deliver SaaS. So we could be making changes to production environments, I mean, on a daily basis even. And then combining that with cloud-based infrastructure, where instead of needing long procurement cycles to acquire physical hardware and rack it and have it available, it was just a programmatic API call away. So what you did was you removed the bottleneck in acquiring the resources to run the software, and then you removed the bottleneck in actually deploying the changes developers were making to software. Now, all of a sudden, for the first time after 40 plus years of IT history, the single biggest bottleneck to having a change in business priority be represented in a change in working code, the bottleneck is the developer. How fast can the developer move? Not other things. And so that really unlocked, I think, both the need for more and more and more developers because they're the bottleneck, but also like the single most important thing is how quickly your developers can move. I mean, when I was running my engineering teams, one of my head of operations coined Ruscio's Law, because when they wanted to bring some new kind of process into effect, I said, first we have to measure what it's going to do to developer velocity. If it's going to increase developer velocity, we'll make almost any change. If it's going to reduce developer velocity, there are good reasons for those kind of changes, whether it's governance or compliance or whatever, but we're going to put an incredibly high hurdle for making that change to the process if it's going to slow developers down. And a big part of my investing thesis and how I look at companies is through that same lens. Does this give a developer more leverage, a security engineer more leverage? Does it help them move faster? Does it help the business change software more quickly and more safely? And that those changes and increase the number of developers means, yeah, now this is a huge market. The other thing, if you'll let me just keep going for a minute, because about 10 years, another thing that happened, and a big part of Heavybit's founding thesis, which was quite contrarian at the time, the firm was founded in late 2012, is this notion that every generational business, regardless of the vertical of the economy it's in, is going to be a software company. And now that has actually played out. I don't care what you're doing. If you make over a certain amount of ARR, you have to employ software developers to build proprietary automation, leverage, multi-channel, et cetera, in your shop. And this is why companies, the Home Depot is a world-class software company today. Domino's Pizza is one of the best software companies on the planet today. And so this is the other aspect of just how large these markets are now is your target. I mean, when I used to pitch in 10 plus years ago, investors would really struggle. They'd say, oh, okay, well, tell us who are you targeting? What's your target vertical? And I'd throw up the logo slide and I would say, literally every company is our target vertical. Like you don't. And so, yeah, but I think, you know, now that is thankfully, I think much more obvious now in 2024.
No, absolutely. You're right. I mean, I do remember when I raised my first VC investment, it was back then in 2007. It was not very obvious to most of the VC investors that there is a market. If you have something that you are selling to developer community, just, you know, we are talking about 2007, not.
It was, I would even say it was less than obvious. Like there was a truism because I was pitching, you know, similar companies back then as well. And you would literally say to your face, be like, hey, nobody makes money selling to developers. That was the kind of the pithy, you know, Silicon Valley and investors love one-liners that, you know, take a very complex scenario and boil it down to, you know, something way too simple. But yeah, the going wisdom was nobody makes money selling to developers. Developers have no, you know, purchasing authority. They have no ability to get anything done. And so it's a losing battle. But I think, like I said, it missed there was a sea change going on underneath the waterline that is now pretty obvious. And it's, I think it swung even to the other extreme, is there are pieces of software where the buyer and the budget is not in the engineering team, but behind the scenes, the engineering team is a key stakeholder who has to approve whether or not they want to deal with that piece of software being integrated into the systems. And there are deals that get lost, you know, selling to the CFO or selling to the head of product because the engineering team says, no, 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 this product is no good for developers. Its developer experience is terrible. There's another product over here. Stripe is a world-class example of this. You know, I when I was at SolarWinds, heading the engineering for cloud there, we had to bring in a unified billing solution. And it was absolutely the CFO's decision because they were doing revenue recognition and all that stuff. But the feedback I gave them was we could move this quickly with Stripe. It's going to take us four times as long with some of the alternatives. And like I said, engineering developer hours are one of the most precious, expensive resources that companies have. So you have to weigh that when you're making those decisions.
Now, talking about developer velocity that you mentioned, AI definitely is playing a role, right? So you have seen, and I bet any company that is, you know, working with developers from many different fronts, you see utilities helping companies from code review perspective, from QA perspective, from generating some simple code perspective, is already in play. It's not like we are talking about future. It's impacting already. Some of these utilities are impacting the development team and helping them to build a better product. Now, how far do you think it's going to go? It's going to get to the point that is actually replacing some of the developers at one point? Do you think it always AI will remain to be a kind of augmenting the development team and make them more productive and adding to the velocity? What's your perspective on that front?
Yeah, it's I think that's a really interesting area to discuss. And so I think it's one of the most fascinating developments. You know, like I said, I've been working in these areas. I had my first paid programming gig in 1998, I think. And so I've seen a couple now cycles of the IT revolution. And I like to think I'm slightly a student of history. I think this is one of the most fascinating moments since, you know, the start of computing. That being said, I have very strong, you know, kind of opinions, and it's going to be interesting to see this play out. I think AI and, you know, generative AI, you can already see, I mean, some of the words you use in terms of augmenting or accelerating, there's very clearly a place for generative AI, I think, to give certainly senior developers superpowers that they didn't previously have, to dramatically increase the productivity and output of those developers. I think there's also, from an educational perspective and accelerating the growth and development of junior engineers into senior engineers, very significant capabilities. I think there's a large amount of very trivial software that needs to be, that is created and needs to be created and managed in terms of whether it's just, I don't know, basic websites for small businesses or glue kind of scripting that interconnects different systems, like integrations between different enterprise AIs, different enterprise APIs. There's lots and lots of places where we've historically spent probably overpowered resource in a human engineer to create a pretty simple and repeatable piece of software that generative AI is going to remove the need for. The thing where I think we're at a very interesting moment in the hype cycle is there is a very real sense, and I would posit mostly from people who have never actually had to write or manage significant software, that somehow this is going to completely replace the vast majority of software engineers. I have to be honest, that notion to be laughable. And, you know, history will eventually tell if I'm right or not. But I have the reasons I don't believe that is for a number. One is, if you just look, even just on the face of it, a principal or senior engineer, and you ask them what percentage of their time they spend, like I like to say, like meat on keyboard, it's actually very small. Like the bulk of really sophisticated large-scale software engineering is coordinating large groups of humans, reaching decisions about very strategic and architectural level choices, fighting against Conway's law, and the impacts it has on the resulting software. And that is not something that generative AI is good at or even claims to be good at. Also, the other interesting thing about the whole history of IT is every time, you know, whether it's introducing compilers or even, you know, introducing higher level language that, you know, manage memory, going from things like C to Java, et cetera. Every time we introduce one of these productivity boosts, the only thing we do as humans is raise the ambition of the software systems we're trying to create, right? Like every time we make it easier to build more complex software, we just attempt to build dramatically more complex software. We always find the limits of what the current technology supports. And I don't think that's ever going to stop, right? And I think, you know, the notion that the world's appetite for software or increasingly complex, sophisticated software is ever going to be finished, I just don't believe. And so, yeah, I think the generative AI is just an incredible productivity boost, going to be super interesting. You can look at like the GitHub Copilot stats they're publishing. Like, as you said earlier, like, it's clear this is actually happening. This isn't debatable, right? Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people are going to learn a very hard lesson about trying to completely remove humans from the process over the next few years, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, that kind of cycle that it may go to the overhype cycle and then come back and then, you know, get settled on more practical, pragmatic kind of level.
Yeah, and this is why when I speak to entrepreneurs about it, I'm experienced enough that I don't get too excited about it because I'm like, look, this is just always the way these things work, right? And you know, it's the kind of thing too where people always, I find that, you know, people overestimate what can be done in a year, underestimate what can be done in 10 years. I'm sure 10, 20 years from now, I mean, it's like anything, there'll be tasks where we'll kind of be shocked that humans used to do it in engineering. But I also don't think the number of engineers is going to be less. The other, you know, the other important lens, which I think some people miss, is there are certain tasks where having a machine able to hit a 90, 95% or even 98% accuracy rate is more than sufficient and a huge win. You know, things like the image generation, you know, where it's very easy to go from that to interpolate to a correct result. There's a separate set of tasks where it has to be 100% correct all the time and anything short of that. And this is where I think with generative AI, people are doing really fascinating things like using separate models to update the output of other models and chaining things together and all kinds of like, you know, really innovative permutations to try and drive that accuracy number as high as possible. But there are cases where if you don't get it to 100%, it doesn't matter. Like humans will get fired if they don't hit 100% in those tasks. And so that's the other, I think in the excitement, people kind of miss some of the details like that. But yes, I think it's a classic hype cycle. I'm excited to get through the trough of disillusionment and find it's the plateau of enlightenment, right? So I'm excited to get there.
Yeah, you raised a good point. It's just choosing the right use case, right? So for example, in our case, you can use AI to help you just create the first version of your dashboard, metrics, visualizations, build the right data set for you. And that saves you a good amount of time. It doesn't have to be perfect because then it's just the starting point. And then you go there and just complete the work versus if you are expecting AI to remove the human and just go there and just create all the analytics and give you the analytics, it might be 99% correct. That means it's worthless. Because you don't know when that 1% is going to be. And essentially, it's something that has to be perfect. You cannot pass that report or analytic to anyone and just say, you know what, it's just 2% chance that these numbers are not correct. But, you know, if you use it in the right way, you already have saved a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, and I'd say the other thing besides just saving time is it's helping. This is something regardless of what a SaaS platform is doing, what vertical they're in. I mean, I tell all my founders this and your audience, you should definitely be using AI. That getting started case, not just in the saving time, but in helping your user overcome the activation energy required to start something. I think one of the biggest challenges SaaS products have with their users is just getting them past the fear or the activation energy required to try a new thing with the SaaS product. Because everyone's just so ingrained of like, oh, this is, it's going to be complicated and I'm going to have to go read some docs that are probably a little out of date or maybe not fully complete. And, oh, maybe I won't. But if you're using, you know, a tool like AI to say, no, 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 just type here in the prompt what you want. And you're going to get something that's like you said, 80, 90, 95% of the way there. And at that point you sit down and you just finish it. And by the way, let alone if you've got the prompt set up, so as they're finishing it, it's there to help them, you know, with whatever else they get stuck on. I think that's a huge win. But in my mind is, although from a 50,000 foot view, it may look almost the same, is a wildly different application than try to remove the human, right? And if I zoom way out, like I am incredibly pro and focused on uses of this technology that give humans superpowers outside of like some very tightly, you know, defined things like, usually all to do with like text summarization or translation or copy editing, where like you literally have discrete inputs and outputs and you can pretty much verify the entirety completeness. I'm looking for things that give humans superpowers, not things that are looking to replace humans, because I just think outside of very specific use cases, trying to replace humans completely is a tough, tall order.
Now getting back to, getting out of AI now and asking you a question that is very specific to what you do. In regular basis, when you are talking to investors, they are helping entrepreneurs, founders to really get the funding and bring their vision and make it, bring their vision to real life and make it a reality. But in your case, there's some extra components that makes it very unique, because in your case, you are really helping these developers that they need to build a business out of their expertise and technologies, and you help them to really perfect and, you know, fine tune their go-to-market strategy. And that's something that maybe the technical community in general is not what they have been trained on. It's not like they have spent majority of their time and training on go-to-market strategies, right? So they have been busy learning the technology and working. So that is very much needed. That is very complimentary, and it's money that you are giving them. And that's good and very powerful tool to have for any entrepreneur. Oxygen is something you have to stay alive and continue working. But at the same time, the other aspects that you are helping them, and also focus that you have, that only working with that selected group of businesses that are very tailored and very focused on what, you know, they do, that should be make you very kind of positioned very uniquely, and I think very high value kind of position that brings to you.
Yeah. I think, I mean, look, this is part of the reason why when I chose to get into investing, like I joined a team at Heavybit. My last company, I mean, we were a Heavybit portfolio company, but I believed and I experienced that kind of value firsthand as an entrepreneur. And I believe, to your point, almost all of our founders are just brilliant technologists, product people. They all have a clear, crisp vision of a future that they know needs to exist that will make builders, again, like developers or security engineers or SREs or DevOps, make their lives better, make them more productive. It literally just make their work more joyful in almost all cases. But to your point, have almost zero background in go-to-market, right? And in fact, I would say just, you know, if you indulge in some stereotypes about, you know, and I was one of these people, so I speak with love when I say this, but, you know, their kind of commercial instincts are often actually harmful, right? Like they hate talking to salespeople. They, you know, there's all this. And so, you know, I think the very first thing we do, which I think a technologist appreciates, is just help them understand actually like, okay, these businesses, even on the go-to-market side, they ultimately are scalable systems. So this is how, like, if you pick it apart, this is how the engine works. This is how like the inputs and outputs work. And this is why, you know, like, I know you think salespeople are icky, but this is why we're going to employ a lot of them ultimately. And you're going to be very happy that you do when we get there. Right. But this is how you build it the right way. And like a classic trap, for example, you see is a founder like that, because they don't like sales, you know, they say, okay, well, I'm just going to hire a VP of sales because I don't want to think about that. Right. Not at all. I like product. I want to build product. I want to do the technology, and I'll just hire someone else to do the business. And that almost always fails, because as we coach founders, it's like, look, you as the founder, only the founders can find product market fit. Only the founders can figure out how to sell the first, I don't know, 5 enterprise contracts, right? There's no one else who has the intersection of all the pieces of knowledge required to figure out how to do something that, by definition, no one else has ever figured out yet. Because if you're building a generational company, you're the first one doing it, right?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I think helping them get there. And I think it helps, you know, almost all the partners at Heavybit are ex-founders like myself. So I think there's an aspect of having been in the arena, right? And having, like, you know, we can empathize deeply with how challenging it is. We can relate to them. They have to figure it out. This isn't something like where I can just hand them an instruction set. But we can be there to help. And I think that's critically important. I think venture now, I mean, I'm sure there's some listeners out there who are struggling with a fundraise right now, and I empathize with that. So I don't mean to be trite, but there is, like, capital is very much a commodity. So once you've kind of figured out how to explain to investors the value in what you're doing, like, you should really be selecting your investors on a axis other than money, because there's probably multiple places you can get it from. And I believe, I think it was Mark Andreessen who put forward a couple of years ago this notion that venture is industrializing, so to speak, and splitting into, very large brand mega funds on one side, kind of a barbell shape, and on the other side, boutique specialist firms with incredibly deep expertise in an area. And I believe that too, and we are one of those boutique firms. And yes, we believe that if you are building developer first or technical practitioner first company in infrastructure, and you're a pre-seed seed, we're, like, bar none the best place to help you, like, accelerate and inflect on that journey. We spend all of our time on that and focus in that area.
No, it makes perfect sense. And what you said about, you know, some of the investment firms choose to be very specialized and focus on a particular domain and segment it out. And of course, there are many, you know, bigger firms that they might be, you know, investing in a variety of cases, but they are not necessarily super specialized in that particular domain. Makes perfect sense. And it has happened in other domains. Why not happening in the VC community as well, right? Now, I know that you guys have a website that you publish or you share a lot of educational content with people that might be interested to really learn more. Can you tell us a little bit about that part if people are interested to check it out?
Yeah. And so all this stuff we've been talking about at a high level on, you know, go to market, how to build your company, how to land your first customers, how to scale a sales team. We've been around for just over 10 years now, and, you know, got our start. We started out as a go-to-market accelerator for developer-first companies. We've now since devolved. We've raised capital funds. But as part of that, like, we've always had, as part of our mission, an educational component. And a choice we made very early on, as we brought in all these, you know, not just our expertise, but, like, other subject matter experts building some of the leading companies, you know, you're talking about companies like Stripe, like PagerDuty, like HashiCorp, like GitHub. We brought in leaders from those companies to basically share their learnings in these particular areas. And every one of those, you know, we've done, basically, like, high fidelity recordings, transcripts. So we have the Heavybit library, which has now, you know, well over 1,000 individual pieces of content. We have curated lists. So if you're looking to do better at pricing your product, which is an incredibly important, particularly for self-serve products, which have an enterprise plan on top of it, how you price and the signals your pricing plan sends to the market, how it levers people up from one plan to another, is, like, an incredibly important part which is often an afterthought, but an incredibly important part, really, of product management and defining your whole product. And we have like a wealth of kind of content on topics like that that just goes really deep. It's all free. You can just come to heavybit.com, I think it's /library, the library, and you can browse through and pick. And yeah, honestly, I mean, it's just great, because many times I meet an entrepreneur, when I meet an entrepreneur for the first time, one of the first things they say is, hey, we've been working on this. I've been going through all the content in your library. It's super helpful. Which is just really rewarding to hear. And yeah, we're still adding to it. We have a great podcast network too, with a number of different podcasts in different areas that cover that as well. So yeah, if nothing else, I encourage, if you're an entrepreneur out there wrestling with these things, as really every entrepreneur never stops wrestling with these things, like you might find something helpful in there.
Super. There are so many other questions I would love to ask, but we are running out of time, Joe, and I appreciate you being here, and we have had a great discussion. I would love to, ask you and learn, how do you know it's time to go change gears and go and, you know, scale the business? I would love to know, you know, what are the different phases of these companies when developers are starting a company? What phases, from your perspective, they go through? I would love to know what kind of investments good for them, what kind of investments may not be the best approach, when is the timing to go and just do it? So many other zillions of topics, but unfortunately, we are running out of time, and I don't know, maybe we can reconnect at some point and go to the kind of episode two of this kind of interview. But at this point, I would love to ask you a question and end the discussion with this question, that if you could share some books with us that you personally liked, maybe professionally or personally, you thought this is a good book and you would like to share with the audience as well.
Always happy to find some time to chat. It's been fun. But on books, so yeah, I have a few. And look, I like the classics, I think, particularly when talking about business. High Output Management by Andy Grove is a classic and a perennial favorite. The reason I like it is, having been an engineer and working mostly with founders who were engineers, Andy Grove is an engineer. And if you read that book, you can see where a lot of what he espoused was taking like an engineering mindset to business, but also adapting it. I mean, just with a surreal, you know, where I think the vast majority of engineers, probably myself included, from first principles would take all the wrong kind of engineering approaches to business. Like, Andy just had this clearly just natural talent for taking the right approaches from engineering to scaling a business. There's every few pages in that book has some really great unlock. And it's a pretty terse read too, from an engineer. It's no wasted. It's a very high, very high content signal to noise ratio book. The only other one I'll mention then is, Steve Blank's 4 Steps to the Epiphany. And that's important, again, coming, I guess, with my lens. Engineers have a tendency to get very kind of myopic, and they have their own perspective on the right way to do things. And our founders definitely, like I said, directionally have this notion of the right way to do things, but there's this trap of not getting out in the real world and adjusting your right way of doing things to meet your customers where they are. And that is where I would say most technical background founders, if they fail early, fail because they don't understand that even if they're right in the absolute sense, in the mathematical sense, what matters is meeting your customers where they are. And what's helpful about Steve's book, that one's a little harder of a read to get through, but he makes it very clear, and he gives you very kind of tactical instructions on like, no, you have to, quote, get out of the building, you have to talk to customers, and here's a systemized way to like record that and understand like what it means. So when I'm talking with one of our typical founders, those are both like incredibly helpful books to meet those founders where they are and explain to them like how they need to grow and mature to be like a successful founder.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Again, it was very insightful discussion. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, it was great. Had a really great time. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to sasscale.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.